Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Kaelin McPherson.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Jolene Russ's reaction to the Fair and Timely Parole Bill and the Elder Parole Bill. Then we speak with Alexis Goldsmith from Beyond Plastics about her work, and we get some information about some plastic in the environment. Later on, Ellie von Weltheim explains how her Mooncatcher project and how it provides menstrual products for girls around the world. After that, Moses Nagel investigates into whether schools will make kids wear masks to school this fall. And finally, Gabe Cruz Allen talks with a local artist musician, Robert Eaton. But first, here are the headlines.
Avril Park's Rudy Winkler is headed to the Olympics after breaking U.S. record in hammer throw. His throw of 271 feet, 4 inches surpassed a national mark that had stood for 25 years. 5 of his throws surpassed 80 meters. No one else in the 12-man field reached 80 meters even once.
The Times Union reports that the Bishop Edward Scharfenberger doesn't support a blanket rule denying communion to politicians who support abortion, a spokeswoman said after the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops vehemently debated that topic.
Current restrictions banning non-essential travel across the northern border will extend again until July 21st, Canadian officials announced Friday.
The Record reports that Ulster County is one of the number of communities participating in a pilot program for a universal basic income. As part of the pilot program, funded by private donations, 100 county residents making less than $46,900 annually will get $500 a month for a year. The annual threshold was based on 80% of the county's average median income, meaning it includes both the poor and a slice of the middle class. The Center for Guaranteed Income Research at the University of Pennsylvania, which the school forms with mayors for a guaranteed income, is evaluating the pilot program.
Politico reports that New Yorkers looking to purchase an adult-use marijuana at one of the state's upcoming recreational dispensaries may have to wait at least 18 months, if not longer, because of political jockeying over leadership of the state's fledgling cannabis industry. Observers continue to question whether the governor actually supports legalization.
That's it for the headlines.
For those just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC, Low Power 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS, Low Power 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA, Low Power 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA, Low Power 107.3 FM Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from Sanctuary Sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call us at 518-272-2390.
We've been covering the Fair and Timely Parole Bill, the Elder Parole Bill, Clean State, and more on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. But none of these bills made it through this session in New York State Legislature. Advocate Jolene Russ reacts to the lawmakers in action in this interview with Elizabeth Press.
Today, I'm joined by Jolene Russ, a person directly impacted by the prison system, and she's fighting for the release of her husband, Brian Russ. Jolene, welcome back to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thanks so much for having me back.
So before we dive into anything related to your personal story, the legislature just closed for the summer, and there were some bills that were on the table related to fair and timely parole and elder parole and many other actual bills related to justice reform. And I'm wondering if you can respond to what just happened in the legislative session.
Man, that is a disappointment for sure. Like you had mentioned, fair and timely and elder parole. They're both great bills. Fair and timely personally, honestly, the way the parole carceral system, New York State should operate, that's how it should be. It would value a person for who they are today, release them based on what they've done since being incarcerated. You know, not just keep going back to the day of the crime. Elder parole, that's another, like, no-brainer. It really felt like this was going to be the year that we would see these bills finally pass because, you know, they sold us a real big dream of reimagine, reinvent, that we were going to rebuild, we were going to do better, we were going to learn the lesson, and it doesn't seem like that happened at all. There were some other great bills on the table. Clean Slate was out there. That got to the floor and it got bounced around, and they ended up not passing that. They did pass a bill that's referred to as Less is More. That's a good bill, but it goes after parole on the back end after a person is released. And it seemed like after everything we learned with COVID, and after everything that we had all been through throughout the pandemic, that we would finally see an overhaul to this system that is so unjust and has always been so racially fueled. Like, it's known as a racist system. The prison system, extended by the policing system, all of that. It felt like it was going to be our year, and it's a huge disappointment that Fair and Timely didn't get to the floor. The elder parole never even got the kind of votes that it needed to. And that, like, there's so much dead legislation. There's so much legislation that's out, good legislation, and some of it very modest, that could have been passed. Things like Assemblyman Robert Carroll, he holds a bill that would cap sentencing at, like, 25 years. It's a modest change, and it makes a lot of sense because it could save a lot of dollars. People are so abstinent and so stuck. They don't want to see anything really change. I could go on with this for a long time because I have a lot of disappointment, not just in the legislative process, but in the legislators themselves.
And so they had the supermajority, right? So if this can't happen with the supermajority, what happens sort of with the activist side going into the next session?
That's a great question. That's exactly what we've been asking. Like, what do we do now if we have the supermajority now? If you're not going to pass it now, this year, then when? When is going to be the right time to do this? Like, it just feels like they don't want the change that they really talk about. They talk about they want these system structures to be better. They want them to be more equal. They want them to be more just and fair. And it's all really feeling like lip service. Because we meet with these legislators. We meet with their staff. We meet with all kinds of people and do this advocacy work and tell our stories and really put ourselves out there and give them the nitty gritty and the vulnerable parts of us. And over and over and over again, not once, not 1 year, not 2 years, for several years. And now you have a supermajority. You're still doing nothing. It just feels like you really don't want the change that you talk about. And that's very sad. You lose trust in government when you participate honestly for so long and you get so little result. It affects you. I understand why a lot of people lose faith in government or in politicians and why they get the rap that they do, because they don't bring the change that they talk about.
Now, Jolene, Russ, we're entering the summer season here, where last summer in the Capital Region, we had a ton of gun violence. What is your reaction to linking gun violence with the importance of releasing rehabilitated people from prison?
Man, that's complicated. But if you really think about it, it's something that really needs to be explored. There is a generation of people missing from these communities. It's a lot of young kids that need these elders that are in prison, that if they continue on the path that they're currently on right now, that is glorifying a violent lifestyle or, you know, using guns to control their environment. People use guns for a lot of reasons, and I'm not going to sit here and act like I know about them all. There's one person that could tell you about gun violence, and that's someone that has committed gun violence and that's sitting in prison and that has learned the lessons of their experiences. But by the time that these young people get to these mentors that we all talk about in all the stories that we've told the legislators, the damage has been community. The damage has been done to the families. The damage has been done to the victims. The damage has been done to the families of the people in prison. So we need to make our system work for us. Instead of continuing this cycle of incarceration, continuing this cycle of over-punitiveness, which I'm not exactly sure is a word, but like being fixed on punishment doesn't serve anyone. If we don't want to transform people, if we're not looking to rehabilitate people and then bring them back out in the community to enhance the same situations that they harmed, what are we really doing? Some people may say that releasing people right now with the gun violence isn't the best choice. Who's the most credible messenger right now to go to someone that's in the midst of the lifestyle of gun violence than someone that has committed the gun violence? We need to think, explore all the options here. What has been done already isn't working now. It never worked in the beginning. They declared a war on drugs in this country, right? So eventually that produced mass incarceration. And then the war on crime enhanced mass incarceration. The 94 crime bill, things of this nature, all they did was create these huge sentences for people that you can't live down. So now we have a generation of people that have been locked away in cells, generations, plural, of people who have been disenfranchised. So gun ownership, which is a constitutional right in this country, is now a crime for you. The topic is so huge, so it's hard to zero in on what the actual answer is. But maybe the short of it is to start the conversation with everyone at the table, including the people that have committed gun violence. Everyone knows me as an advocate for clemency because we've been applying for a commutation for my husband by way of executive clemency through the governor for about 5 years now. The governor could sit down, and he a lot of times will award clemency to people that do aggression replacement training or anti-violence programs. He could gather up a lot of people that are in prison right now that have applied for clemency. He's got thousands of applications on his desk. He could put these people into a committee of some sort or a council of some sort. He could use the resources that are at his disposal. He could get them in the conversation. He could release them. He could. There's so many people in prison who come out here and are doing such good. That's where your answer is. It's in there.
Julian, so you mentioned your husband, Brian Russ, who you've been advocating for his clemency.
There's two different kinds of sentences in New York State, indeterminate sentences and determinate sentences. And Brian has a determinate sentence of 40 years, and then does 85% of that, that's 34 years. So the short answer is he has 13 years left to serve.
Jolene, we're quickly running out of time, but I just want to make sure that I give you the last word. Is there anything else that you want to make sure that we touch on here in this interview today?
I think we need to stop trying to look through the same old lens and really broaden our picture so we can get to the roots of the problem. There's been so many people that are left out of the conversation or thought to be tossed away by society in general, whose voice could be extremely valuable here. But the relationships need to be built, and it's got to start somewhere. So like every person, the way that is done is just by being a half less judgmental when you start a conversation. Instead of having to know what you're talking about, just accept that you want to listen first.
Great. Jolene Russ, thank you so much for joining us again on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you.
That was Elizabeth Press giving us continued coverage of the Fair and Timely Parole Bill, speaking with Jolene Russ, an advocate for that bill.
Next, we hear our weekly plastic bucket, which means we'll be bringing you a regular segment around the conversation about plastic and its environmental impact. This week, we are speaking with Alexis Goldsmith of Beyond Plastics. She'll tell us about the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Bill, the downside of recycling, and what changes we need to implement.
Hi, I'm Alexis Goldsmith, and I am the National Organizing Director for Beyond Plastics and the former HMM coordinator.
I would love to start off with some basic facts about plastic usage. Could you give us some statistics that the listeners might connect with?
Well, plastic use, as we know, has a huge impact on our environment because it doesn't biodegrade. So currently, the U.S. is producing 36 million tons of virgin plastic every year, and that number is increasing. 99% of plastics are produced from oil and gas, and the majority of plastics in the U.S. are produced from ethane, which comes from hydraulic fracturing. So it's had an enormous impact on our environment, as we know. If you've heard of the movie The Story of Plastic, I highly recommend it to see how it's impacted not just our oceans and our waterways, but also countries overseas and our own bodies. The average person is ingesting actually a credit card's worth of plastic every week, because plastic in the environment, as it breaks down into microplastics, which are now permeating our waterways, our air, and our food. So we are actually ingesting that microplastic from the environment.
Microplastics are broken down pieces of plastic, but they're also microfibers. Could you talk a little bit more about what microplastics are?
Right. So microplastics are just tiny pieces of plastic. They're very small. They can be very difficult to see. They come from many different sources. As you mentioned, microfibers in our clothes. Most of our clothes now are made from plastics. So when we wash them, you can have millions of microplastics washing off into your washing machine water that then goes into your wastewater. Microplastic sources come from the plastics production itself. So plastic is made at a facility called an ethane cracker, and there's all this infrastructure that goes with it, like rail lines and pipelines and injection wells. But the ethane cracker turns ethane into polyethylene, which is the building blocks of plastic, and they manufacture it into these tiny lentil-sized pieces of plastic, and they readily spill into the environment wherever they're transported. They're like glitter, basically. They fall off of barges and off of train cars and things like that. So it's estimated that half of all microplastic pollution actually comes from these plastic pellets. They're called nurdles. And it also comes from plastic litter. If you see plastic litter on the street, there'll be a heavy rain. It washes into the storm drains, and then it'll wash into the Hudson River and eventually into the ocean, where it breaks down into microplastics and can circulate in waterways all over the world.
I'd love to talk about Beyond Plastics, where you now work. What is Beyond Plastics and what is your role at the organization?
Beyond Plastics is a national project dedicated to all the societal changes that it'll take to end plastic pollution. And it's spearheaded by our president, Judith Enck, our former EPA regional administrator. And at Beyond Plastics, I do the organizing work. So I work with volunteers, former students of Judith's, anybody who wants to get involved on this issue, to organize for those changes that we need. So we're working on a couple of different things, including helping Meals on Wheels programs switch to reusable containers and supporting national legislation like the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act.
Do you want to give a quick blurb about what is the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act?
I would love to. The Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act is an omnibus federal bill that is the most comprehensive plastic waste reduction bill that has ever been introduced. It was introduced in March by Senator Merkley and Representative Lowenthal, and it basically tackles plastic pollution from source to grave. It puts a pause on new federal permits for plastic production facilities, which is a big deal because plastics manufacturing right now is expanding at an incredible rate. The American Chemistry Council estimates that plastic production in the U.S. will triple in the next 30 years without intervention. It eliminates single-use plastics nationwide, like plastic bags and straws. It imposes post-consumer recycled content requirements for plastic bottles and a whole host of other things. If people want to learn more about it, I really encourage you to just look it up, the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act.
Excellent. Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act. And you mentioned plastic bags, straws, one-use materials. So how much of plastic production and waste depends on an individual and how much of it is coming from corporations. Or in other words, how much are we self to blame? How much of our life changes impact the overall plastic pollution? Or is it really legislation on corporations that is the most effective?
Right. That's a really important question. So obviously behavior change is important and education, like preventing plastic from escaping into the environment. But this is really a production issue and not a consumption issue. Plastic production is what's driving the so-called demand for single-use plastics, the demand that the American Chemistry Council is hoping to see increase by 3 times in the next 30 years. But many people may have noticed that in the past 20 years or so, everything has become single-use plastic and much of the packaging has become single-use plastic. So consumers really don't have much of a choice when it comes to how much plastic they are consuming in their lives. I challenge anybody listening to go to a grocery store and buy your groceries in no single-use plastic. Go to a hardware store and get the parts you need, no single-use plastic. You know, the list goes on and on. And it's also an access issue. You can go zero waste, but you need some level of privilege and access to be able to do that. So we really need federal legislation to reduce single-use plastics and improve reuse and refill systems. I forgot to mention that plastics recycling has been a huge failure. Less than 10% of plastics are recycled, and it's really, the truth is most of our plastic recycling is incinerated or shipped overseas or landfilled. So the recycling has really just been a cover for the industry to make people feel more comfortable with using plastics, when in reality, it's just been a scam.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I think only recently has it really become a part of discussion. It almost increased the use of plastic because people no longer had this bad feeling of plastic going into the regular garbage, but they thought they were actually part of a sustainable cycle, which it really is not. Is that right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And now the industry is pushing something called chemical recycling because they have to acknowledge that recycling has been a failure to address the problem. But, you know, I won't believe any industry promises on sustainable solutions until they actually reduce virgin plastic production. And chemical recycling is just another scam to make people think that their plastic waste is being turned into another valuable product.
So we should focus on the reduce and reuse, maybe also rethink. So how is the policy around plastics in New York State at the moment?
Well, the New York State passed the plastic bag ban, which was huge, and DEC is enforcing it. I thank DEC Commissioner Basil Sagos for enforcing the bag ban. Before the ban, New Yorkers were using 25 billion single-use plastic bags every year. So that's a huge difference. New York City just passed a ban on plastic straws, except upon request, because, of course, there are some accessibility issues there as well. So we're making progress, but really federal and state legislation is lagging far behind solving the problem.
I would love to have some final thoughts from you on how our listeners can get involved and how to support Beyond Plastics and any other last thoughts.
We can go to our website, beyondplastic.org. I recommend everybody listening contact their congressional representative, such as Paul Tonko, probably, if you're in our listening area, and ask him to co-sponsor the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act. Contact Senator Schumer and ask him to pass this important bill. And listen to The Plastics Bucket, which is a new piece, new series that I will be putting out on HMM every week. And I'll be talking about all these different aspects of plastic pollution and how it intersects with international, social, and environmental justice issues.
That was Alexis Goldsmith of Beyond Plastics. And for our plastic bucket, and a bucket at Hudson Mohawk Magazine is a weekly segment. So Alexis has created the plastic bucket. So tune in next week and every week, at least for the foreseeable future, to hear stories about plastics and how they impact communities, individuals, the environment, and so forth.
For those just tuning in, I'm Kaelin McPherson.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary. Ellie von Welsheim explains how the Mooncatcher Project, a non-for-profit organization she started in Schenectady to provide washable, reusable menstrual products to girls, has expanded to 29 countries, providing education for boys and girls about body changes, as well as economic development for women in some locations through sewing cooperatives. This is part two of an interview with HMM's Bria Barthel.
Hi, this is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Today, I have the honor of talking with Ellie von Welsheim, who started the Mooncatcher Project out of her home in Schenectady, and it has since expanded to over 59 countries, providing economic development and menstrual supplies for girls and women. So, Ellie, if you could tell us a little more about the Mooncatcher Project and what you give to girls to help them.
Well, thank you for having me. And yes, we give a kit, a reusable, washable menstrual kit to girls living in poverty throughout the world, along with a curriculum. We always make sure to give an educational component every time we give out one of these kits. Inside the kit, there is a carrier that holds the pad, and the carrier goes between your legs and then ties around your waist so that there's no need for underwear with our kit. If you happen to have underwear, you just pull it on up over the carrier. But for a lot of these girls, that's a luxury item to have underwear. So we wanted to make sure that they weren't left out. A lot of these pads that people make, which are fabulous, I never want to put down anybody else's product because we need everybody at the table. But a lot of them are made to snap around underwear. Ours don't do that. You don't have to have underwear. In the kit, we give three pads, one to wear, one change into, and one that's drying on the line and ready to put on the next time. We also give a waterproof bag that you can put your used pad into. We say used, we don't say dirty, we don't say nasty, we don't say anything negative. We are trying to change the language of menstruation. We are trying to remind people that this is a beautiful, wonderful thing that happens in order for the human race to continue. And it shouldn't be anything anybody is embarrassed about or ashamed about. So we say used pad.
You talked about education and how you're trying to change the language. I know that you're going into schools and working with girls, but it was interesting to hear also how you're working with boys. Can you tell us something about the educational component of what you're doing beyond just giving the supplies?
Absolutely. So the education is, there's kind of three parts. One is menstrual management, where we teach the girls how to use the kit, how to keep themselves clean, how to take care of the kit. The other part is about reproductive health. So we really explain what's going on in your body. Why is this happening? Why is this a normal thing? And the third part is we teach boys. And we teach boys not only about the changes that are happening in their bodies, but what's happening to girls. Because what we found after years and years of doing this is that boys were teasing girls, humiliating girls. And sometimes these girls were dropping out of school, not because they had no way of dealing with their period, but because a boy had humiliated them and they were just too embarrassed to come back to school. So we wanted to change that. So we wrote a boys curriculum. And what we found is that boys don't know anything about what's going on. Our education is often the first time they actually hear the truth about why girls have periods. And once they hear that, once they make that connection about menstruation and babies, they begin to understand that, oh, well, let's help these peers of ours, these girl students that are in school with us. And they become part of the solution rather than continuing to be part of the problem. It's been a wonderful thing.
And you mentioned that teachers are very welcoming for your programs and for the products. Can you say a little bit from that end, from the administrative response or the governmental response or other organizations?
Yeah, I would say for the most part, teachers welcome us with open arms. For one thing, they're really happy to have well-educated people come in to teach about this because they don't always know very much about it. They're well-educated in other ways, but this whole thing about menstruation is often a bit of a mystery to them. We get lots of questions from teachers because they're interested in knowing more themselves. And we do teach the teachers to continue teaching the students. So we give them a lot of information that they can hold on to so that when there's questions from those students, there's some continuity. It doesn't just go away when our teachers walk out of the campus. We want the school to continue this conversation. So they're open and so pleased to have us there.
And you had talked about starting sewing cooperatives in different countries and how those cooperatives go beyond the support for making menstrual products to being, it sounds like self-regulating sewing operations where women can make other things for sale to support themselves. Can you say a bit about that, please?
Yes, this is something that we've always encouraged because it's always made us nervous thinking, well, if they're only working for us, then what happens if we disappear for who knows what reason? So we've always encouraged our sewing cooperatives to find other work, but use all the equipment that they have. So sew whatever they can. And we also have one sewing cooperative that has a savings, I don't know what they call it, like a savings bank within their cooperative where they give, every time they get paid by the Mooncatcher Project, they put a percentage of their pay into this box. Each one puts however much they want. And they save up this money to start a new project. Like, you know, one woman was making soap and another one was selling popcorn and another one was selling mangoes on the side of the road, but they had the startup money for that. So in addition to sewing, they had another business that they were growing. And we're just thrilled with this. We just love this idea. And they take care of all of that. We don't have anything to do with it. We're just excited about it and interested in it, but we don't oversee it in any way.
I'm still astonished that something with such an international presence and such a educational component and economic component started with one woman in her basement harassing her daughter to try out a menstrual pad, a reusable menstrual pad. How can people get involved? You did mention that you used to have Moonbees. Perhaps you can say more about the various options for how people can get involved.
Well, a Moonbee is like a sewing bee, or think about your grandmother's quilting bee. The difference is that we invite men and boys as well as women and girls. It's an opportunity for people to come together to actually work on these kits in the United States. So we have churches and synagogues and all sorts of different places that invite us to come in. They provide the room and the table and the chairs, and we come with the supplies. We ask people to bring their own sewing machines if they sew. You do not have to sew. You don't have to be able to use a sewing machine. You can cut, you can measure, you can pack. There's lots of jobs. And we just divide it all up into what matches your skills. And we make parts, and eventually after enough sewing bees, we have all the parts we need, and then we pack things, and then we send them off to countries where we don't have sewing cooperatives, but we do have schools that need our kit.
Beyond the economic issues, I want to go back a little bit to the political issues. You said that all of this, in part, is challenging the oppression of women, and that it's allowing girls to stay in school. It's allowing women to get involved with the sewing cooperatives. It's allowing women to start their own businesses. Do you get any resistance from governments or from organizations?
Sure. I mean, there's lots of people in the world that don't want women to be lifted up. But we do find from places like World Bank and, a million different prestigious organizations that have done studies on this. And what they find is when a girl has an education, she marries later, has fewer children, more likely to become financially independent, and is much more likely to teach the children that she chooses to have the importance of education. and the importance of community and helping each other. And women have amazing ideas. They have incredible ideas because they are thinking so much about the common good. So educating women and hearing their voices every day of the month is so important. There's places that don't believe this. If you go to Nepal, there's still a practice that's outlawed, but it's still happening, where if you're a menstruating person, you are sent out of the house into a hut during your menstruation because you're considered unclean, dirty. If you touch someone, they believe that you can kill that person, or you can make that person incredibly sick, or you can make the animals sick. You don't want to touch their food. I mean, they really feel like you need to be away from anybody. So they're out in these little huts. They can't stand up in them. They've got smoke inhalation that's happening that often kills them. You've got men coming to rape them because they know they're easy prey. That's oppression of women. We have to stop that.
So Ellie, I want to thank you for everything you're doing. You bring together so many different aspects of environmental justice, economic justice, women's support. And I love the idea that the menstrual queen in Schenectady, New York, has, through what you call an organic process, managed to become such a presence in so many different ways in so many different countries. It's been great talking with you. Thanks for all your work.
Thank you.
That was part two of an interview. That was part two of Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Bria Barthel's interview with Ellie Von Waldheim, who is the creator of the Mooncatcher Project. There's a correction in the intro to this interview. It said 59 countries, but this project is in 29 countries. For more information on the Mooncatcher Project, the website is mooncatcher.org, or hear the first part of the segment on mediasanctuary.org/stories.
Summer has begun, and the school year is coming to an end. However, for many parents, those children have endured a year of social distancing and mask wearing. The fight against restrictions they see as unnecessary is not over. Our own Moses Nagel investigates whether these restrictions are necessary, public health programs are harmful overreach.
10th grader Alexa Bledjek got emotional talking about what it was like to go to school without a mask yesterday.
I saw life everywhere, like my teachers, like I can finally see all the emotion.
We have these two really weak politicians who won't stand up for kids and won't stand up to teachers' unions, and I think that's why people are so scared today, because they see their leadership not standing up for them, not saying it's okay for kids to unmask finally.
This is the sound of an ad run by the group Unmask New York School Children Now. The group has no official information, but it has a Facebook page that was created on May 21st and has swelled in a month to over 13,000 members. They've gotten the attention of several conservative members of the state legislature, including Assemblyman Chris Tague, who introduced legislation in June to prevent state agencies from mandating mask requirements for children.
Governor Cuomo, New York State Legislative Majority Members, and Dr. Zucker, unmask our kids now!
Julie is a mom with kids in Shenandoah and Waterford school districts who's gotten very active in the fight against the school's COVID restrictions.
I started really paying attention in January when my son had a birthday, and he came home and told me that nobody sang happy birthday. And I had reached out because I thought, well, maybe they just forgot. And I was told that they're not allowed to sing. And, you know, I had reached out to the principal and questioned it because it didn't make sense to me. These kids are already sitting 6 feet apart. They're already wearing a mask, but they can yell out an answer to a question or read out loud, but they couldn't sing. Basically, every time you show any concern or questions or you push back, you're just basically treated like, well, you know what? Be grateful that we're still open. And you know what? We are grateful as parents, but at what cost? Because this is causing unnecessary emotional trauma, and it's squashing personality traits. you know, with all the changes that have gone on in the last year and a half, singing songs like happy birthday is a big deal to a small child. And then the school does not allow them to talk while they're eating lunch. Yes, you heard that correct. They are not allowed to eat and talk at the same time while they are having lunch. Talk about oppression. I mean, these kids, it's sickening. It's sickening.
Claire Prophet, supervising public health nurse for Schenectady County, says she's puzzled by the vehemence of resistance so late in the school year when she believes the masks in schools have worked so well.
So I think masks worked fantastically well in schools. I think the science is really pointing towards most COVID being spread through the air by people who are super spreaders, which means that not everybody is spreading COVID to the same number of people, but one person might have a very high viral load and spread it to a bunch of people. And we know that masks are both protective for the wearer and protective for the people around the wearer. I think we saw an amazingly low number of COVID cases in schools. I was somewhat pessimistic about it at the beginning of the year, and I have just been so impressed and amazed by how well the schools have done with in-person learning. I think a big part of it is that school children have adhered to mask wearing in a way that almost nobody else has. Our role is sort of the protection of the many, of the group, of the population, and we have to always be thinking about where does that butt heads with individual autonomy and, you know, your individual rights. I think that we have to think about it really especially carefully when it's children. And I think that in this year, we've really asked young people to sacrifice a lot for older people. And that's a heavy thing to put on them to begin with. It's been a heavy year for the youngest in our society who really had the least risk from COVID all along. And so it is a great question. How much is this an appropriate thing to ask them to do? And when does it just become an imposition for not very much benefit? And I think that we are in the time of that shifting. And that's why what I think for me is really frustrating about people deciding that it has to happen right at this moment is that I think that we're in a natural slide to that happening anyway, because I think everybody at every level wants to make decisions that don't make our children sick or even uncomfortable. Like, we really don't, right? Like, the CDC isn't full of people who wants to make school children feel like extra hot and uncomfortable because they have to wear a mask all day, right? But it does involve a whole lot of people making a really big decision that affects people everywhere from New York, where our vaccination rates are 70%, to parts of the Deep South where vaccination rates are still hovering under 50%. And so we're not being given the leeway to make the decision for ourselves here in New York. We're being told to follow a decision that applies to the whole country. And so I think it is asking for just a little bit more sacrifice. And whether that's a sacrifice too far, you know, at this moment, I guess what we're really hearing from a lot of parents is that they feel it is. I would really argue that this is sort of a, you know, waited out for a little bit longer situation and, you know, make reasonable accommodations. And the guidance really allows for reasonable accommodations, right? It allows for mask breaks. It allows for people to take their masks off while they eat. It allows for them to take them off outside. But if it were up to me, if I were able to ask people what to do, I would say I appreciate the discomfort of this, but just hang on for a little bit longer because things are about to look much, much more normal. I mean, like, by fall, my hope is that in New York, life will look just way more normal than it has for a long time.
I spoke with some people at the press conference announcing the bill who made it pretty clear that for some, at least, the objections went far beyond masks.
Well, this is the thing. They're weakening their lungs by wearing the mask, and so then they're more susceptible to illness. It's a lose-lose situation. And the mask is like putting a chain-link fence up to keep out mosquitoes as far as viral or bacterial, anything is concerned anyways, even if you do believe that that's the way disease is transmitted. You got to step back and look at the bigger picture, which is through the World Economic Forum. This is about money. This is about power. This is about Gates. This is about technocracy. It's a big deal. It's a big picture, and it's a paradigm shift that most people don't have the bandwidth to take on. But we got to take it on because it's a comment. We're going to be enslaved digitally, if we allow this vaccine passport crap to happen and all of that. It's coming, and people have to step back and get the bigger picture, or we're really in some deep, deep fascist craziness.
Curiously, many of the people who want restrictions lifted immediately are also against encouraging vaccinations in kids. Julie told me that her skepticism about vaccinations has only grown during COVID.
You know, I have a lot of concern with that for children. Adults, you know, that's one thing. But children, I'm not on board with that at this moment, and there's just not enough studies done to convince me. And again, I believe that that should be a parent's choice, but it should not be mandated. It should not be mandated for kids to go to school. And, you know, it's my body, my choice, my kid's body, my choice. You know, nobody should be able to tell you what to do, you know, with your child. It's like being told, well, you can't eat chicken or something. Well, who the hell are you to tell me what my kid can eat? It's the same kind of thing. You can't tell me what I should put in my kid's body. I know what's best.
Despite the objections of groups like Unmask New York Children Now, Ms. Prophet feels optimistic about the direction New York is going toward overcoming COVID.
The thing that sort of works in public health's favor is that people who are not convincible about the vaccine are probably statistically more likely to have had COVID and recovered because they probably also didn't want to wear masks or follow some of the rules. So when you're looking at like what it takes to get to herd immunity, you have like people who were vaccinated, you have people with known cases of COVID who, you know, probably have quite decent protection, maybe not 100% protection against some of the variants, but still quite decent protection. And then you probably have a much higher number of people who had COVID and were never tested because, you know, there are lots of people who were like, eh, you know, I felt sick, I probably had it, or, you know, I was exposed and I got a cold or whatever. And so it means that we're really doing well in a year of like not being able to have a lot of optimism about stuff. I feel really optimistic about the way we're going. It's going to be okay. If there are people whose emotional response and like gut feelings about this are not going to allow them to get on board with getting vaccinated or, you know, following social distancing and mask wearing, if they're not vaccinated, I think ultimately that's at this point, it's not going to make too much of a difference.
That was Moses Nagel reporting on the conversation around mask wearing in schools. Moses Nagel has previously reported on the lessening of mask restrictions. So to hear more conversations around that issue, whatever your states on the issue, you can find that on our website at mediasanctuary.org.
An in-person interview with Robert Eaton, a local artist and musician based in Albany, New York. He discusses his various music projects, past and present. He also comments on the impact of COVID-19 pandemic on himself personally and the overall music scene of the Capital Region.
This is Gabe Cruz Allen for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm sitting here with Robert Eaton, who is a local artist and musician, and we're going to talk about some music today. So, Robert, when did you first start learning about and playing music?
I think music was always a part of my life. My mom was a singer, you know, so of course she would just be belting out Janis Joplin tunes in the kitchen. And it just was always a part of my life, you know, and I took some classical piano lessons. I took guitar lessons for a number of years. Guitar was sort of the instrument that I started with. And
okay.
I ended up playing in a band in Amsterdam, New York, for several years. So like got started, you know, playing shows probably by 15 years old. And that got interrupted by getting my, you know, getting through college, and my son was born. And then around 2006, I started to play locally again in Albany as part of Doomsday Virus, which I'm not sure how active we're going to be going forward. We had a show booked right before things shut down, but, you know, we started dabbling with new music over the years, did a lot with Doomsday Virus, ended up largely doing industrial electronica kinds of stuff, did a lot of production for other people, you know, just using what I have here as far as the monitors, the computer, and the synths that I have. I love collaboration. I love bringing other people in. I have a music project that I haven't done much with lately, Destroy 11. It's kind of my solo stuff. It's more or less a vanity project. But I try to bring different musicians to every live show. Okay. I had one particular show that was fun that I had to get. It was just me and a guitarist, you know. And when I came to Albany, like, Doomsday Virus would play a show and the sound guy would be confused because, like, where is your drummer? Why? What do you mean we're playing backing tracks off of a laptop? It wasn't done. And that, of course, thankfully, has changed. You know, there's, you know, I feel like engineers and venues are a lot more welcoming, and you see a lot more electronic type music taking place in Albany performed live. So that's really cool. But that's been something that's changed.
Mm-hmm. And why do you say it's changed?
I really love Albany's music scene for how diverse it has become. You know, you've got all the check marks that you can click off. Your rock band that sounds essentially like 90s indie. You know, you've got your jam band. You've got your metal bands. You've got your hardcore bands. But then, of course, you've got a lot of things that sort of defy those categorizations. Mm-hmm. Of people I've seen or played with that I've really enjoyed. Moon Worship, which I think is no longer active, but that was kind of like this weird Elvis meets the Cramps punk. I don't even know how to categorize it. but cool. So there's a lot of diversity in Albany's scene, and like, I have a lot of respect for musicians working in this area for that reason.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the stage of life that I'm at, when I go into a room and there's like a, you know, 3, 4, 20-year-olds banging out some music, I love it. I live for that sort of thing.
And how do you think that the pandemic has affected all of this, like the local music scene?
Well, I mentioned the Low Beat earlier as a place that's, you know, now a hookah bar, I think. But like, it's going to be difficult. I mean, there's dark spots and there's positives. One of the positives that I think is really, really big for Albany right now is you have Empire Live that moved into the former RPI space, which is basically a mid-sized venue, for live music.
Okay.
And that is awesome. For me personally, when everything shut down, like, I was rehearsing with my friend Ramel. It's project, we don't have much of a web presence. We have, an Instagram, Los, LOSXP. And it's, I wanted to do something very different. And I think, I mean, this was something I started to do before the pandemic. And then we started rehearsing via Google Meet, and until it got too cold, we were rehearsing on a corner of the CDPC property, which was near here. So, you know, him with an acoustic guitar, myself with violin, which was an interesting challenge because I'm not classically trained on violin. I'm entirely self-taught. Mm-hmm. So I wanted a new challenge, and this sort of very different from what I normally do, which is synths mostly, but just an acoustic guitar. My friend Ramel does vocals, and I play the violin.
Mm-hmm. What led you to start your current group that you're in?
Well, I've been doing music, you know, if I think I formed my first band around 1995 or 1996.
So you have experience.
I've been doing this a while, and I've been playing shows in Albany since at least 2006. So violin, it's, if you ever want to have a better trained ear, pick up violin. I mean, I thought piano was a tough instrument, you know, like trying to learn Chopin is about where I got frustrated. My friend Muse started a project and eventually got grant funding, and we did a series of shows and played the Lobby, played the Albany Barn. It was a project called Geek Musica, which was a very, very cool concept. It was classical musicians, and most of them were from SCCC. You know, people studying classical music. I was the only person that wasn't a student. Muse was working on her own degree there. And we just played video game music.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it was so fun. And people really loved it. Like, we were doing music from Mario, which is super challenging to play.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Oh, yeah. We were doing Final Fantasy. You know, we were doing Lord of the Rings music.
So how do you see yourself as a local artist?
It's interesting because I have the perspective of, I can see people that have been in the scene and doing music a lot longer than I have. You know, people like Mark Emanation, which, local blues folk, maybe? Blues musician? And, like, you know, there's the old heads that have been doing it way longer than me. And, like, God bless them, I respect that so much. And that's kind of like my goal, where I want to go. I want to keep making music. I want to keep performing. Like I said, I don't really know, you know, when DV might be active again, Doomsday Virus. I feel like Lost Experience, Lost XP, we're ready to perform at this point. So we're going to look for some opportunities, you know.
Nice.
Probably some outdoor stuff. You know, especially for the originals, because we joke about it, like, the songs we've written just, like, hitting people in the feels. And, you know, that's, like, what I want to do musically is, like, you know, perform and make somebody feel something, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely hear that. Well, that's all the time we have for now, but I just wanted to say thank you so much for interviewing with me.
Thank you.
That was Gabe Cruz Allen in conversation with Robert Eaton, who is a local artist and musician based in Albany, New York. And Gabe has been producing various interviews with local musicians, and you can hear more of those on our website.
That concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Keelan McPherson.
And I'm Sina Bazilahicki, also your engineer. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all of the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in. Stay safe and stay hydrated.